KPLO FM program, Power to People.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Scanner newspaper, featuring local and national news, and now providing the latest in local and national news from an African-American perspective online at www.thescanner.com. The Scanner provides daily updates that keep people informed.
I'm Lena Aliyaloro.
This is Scott Fain.
This is Linda Olsen-Austin.
This is Owen Bastable.
I'm Cicely Rogers.
I'm Lisa Lewis.
I'm Brian Pritchett.
This is Rebecca Nate.
I'm Robert Barncourt.
Volunteer-run, community-powered. This is the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Mayor Adams proposes an increase in downtown parking costs.
Key Bank faces retaliation for its support of Oak Harbor Freight.
And former President Bush faces a lawsuit for war crimes.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 17th, 2009. I'm Rebecca Nay.
And I'm Robert Barncourt. Parking rates in downtown Portland may increase on July 1st. Mayor Adams has recommended an increase from $1.25 to $1.50 an hour at metered spaces and also adding charges for parking on Sunday from 1 to 7 p.m. If the city council approves the plan, the increased revenue should be about $5.5 million per year. The city and Transportation Bureau would use the money for paving projects and bicycle boulevards, as well as increased maintenance costs. In related news, Portland's abandoned auto program, which receives about 18,000 calls per year, is in jeopardy due to budget shortfalls. Last year, more than 1,500 vehicles were ticketed as abandoned and towed away. City officials are hoping to rescue the program by combining it with other departments or funding its cost with an increase in residential garbage pickup charges. But some residents say they would be happy to see the abandoned auto program go, as it sometimes results in the towing of cars that have not been abandoned. Owners have to then pay a hefty fine to get their car back.
The Portland Public School Board will decide later this month whether to close a charter school that serves at-risk teenagers. The school is struggling to stay open under a growing deficit and lower than projected enrollment. Half of the school's students are racial minorities and qualify for the free and reduced lunch program. Many of the teenagers have already dropped out or have been expelled from other community schools. Principal Lorna Fast Buffalo Horse fears that closing the school would increase the district's dropout rates. She says that students have told administrators that if the school did not exist, they would most likely drop out.
Several of Oregon's representatives in the U.S. Congress have taken strong stands on the issue of executive bonuses. Senator Jeff Merkley spoke in the Senate Banking Committee hearing today against the deregulation of the banking industry that took place, for the most part, during the Bush administration. Here's a clip.
Over the past 2 years, the American people have been outraged to discover the existence of a $50 trillion insurance industry that was entirely unregulated. Outraged that this industry could avoid regulation by New York insurance regulators by using the term credit default swaps rather than credit default insurance. Outraged that firms within this industry went regulator shopping to avoid effective oversight. Outraged that the activities of these firms created an asset bubble, the collapse of which has left millions of Americans out of work and millions more with their life savings obliterated. And absolutely enraged at the very same industry that did all these things is richly rewarding its employees with perks and bonuses funded with taxpayer funds.
Senator Jeff Merkley is not the only Oregonian in Congress speaking out on the issue. Representative Earl Blumenauer has introduced a bill in Congress that would tax executive bonuses at 100%. He argued today in the House Ways and Means Committee that the bailout money came from the taxpayers, and instead of going into the pockets of banking executives, it should be returned to the taxpayers.
Close to $5,000 is available as a tax refund to many working Oregon families under the federal earned income tax credit. A report released Monday from the Children's Defense Fund shows that families eligible for the credit are prime targets for refund anticipation scams, such as loans, checks, and other services. According to the latest numbers, that adds up to almost $23 million taken out of previous refunds for Oregon families. KBOO's Caleb Cipolla has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
A refund of close to $5,000 could be especially timely for Oregon families during this recession. That's the upper end of the Federal Earned Income Tax Credit, or EITC, for low to moderate income working families. And a report released Monday by the Children's Defense Fund shows Oregonians eligible for the refund are being targeted by tax preparation companies and those selling refund anticipation loans and checks. Ed Shelby with CDF says those services cost Oregon EITC families about $23 million.
What is often hidden is that there's a lot of fees attached to this, and you can lose a significant portion of what your refund will actually be.
Companies offering the loans and EITC filings say they provide valuable services for families needing access to money quickly and those who feel overwhelmed by tax paperwork. Shelby points out that there is a true free filing available along with direct deposit of refunds through the IRS Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program with locations around the state. CDF is also calling for federal laws to protect families from predatory services and an expansion of free tax preparation offerings. For KBOO News, I'm Caleb Cipolla.
Federal prosecutors in Los Angeles are calling for a 6-month prison sentence for a man convicted of leaking a Guns N' Roses album onto the internet before it was released in stores. Kevin Cogill pled guilty to the misdemeanor crime last December after being arrested at gunpoint in his house. Prosecutors have said they are seeking the prison sentence because what Cogill did represents, quote, one of the more insidious forms of copyright infringement, end quote. Cogill's sentencing is set for May 4th.
And now, a look at the 6th Annual Women, Action, and Media Conference and other stories with Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clements.
It was standing room only in the Commerce Department this week, where three federal agencies hosted the first of 7 public meetings focusing on how to spend $7 billion marked for broadband in President Obama's stimulus package. The National Telecommunications and Information Administration, the Department of Agriculture's Rural Utilities Service, and the Federal Communications Commission are in charge of developing and implementing proposals to distribute the broadband stimulus funds. Before the meeting, public advocates shared their ideas about how to use the funding to create jobs and expand broadband access across the country. Ben Scott, policy director of Free Press, said that the funding process should use new and more reliable data to make sure the money is used to bring broadband networks into areas that are truly unserved or underserved. He wants to fund projects that are an efficient use of taxpayer resources and to invest in a world-class high-speed infrastructure.
We want to make sure that if we build a new infrastructure in rural America for the broadband era, that we're not simply recreating a digital divide by building a substandard network that then has to take another leap in order to catch up with the cities and the states where we put the money.
Markham Erickson spoke for the Open Internet Coalition, a group of internet technology companies. He said his group was thrilled with the provisions in the plan that called for open networks, meaning providers couldn't favor or discriminate certain content or services.
The language instructs the NTIA to make sure that publicly funded networks are open, and we believe the open character of the Internet marketplace is what has fed the engine of economic and job growth in the information, communications, and technology sector for over a decade.
Former Congressman Chip Pickering of Mississippi, a Republican who represented a rural area for many years and served on the key House Technology Committee, said he sees a lot of common ground with those across the aisle when it comes to broadband expansion.
My hope is that we can help NTIA and RUS and FCC as they do this by bringing a broad coalition together. Markham and Ben and I may not agree on some issues, but the fact that we can have this conversation, say that this is very important, and then work together to find the solutions or the consensus that I hope can help the agencies as they make these policy decisions. My hope is that it could be done in a way that maximizes the public interest and the economic growth of our country.
For the past 6 years, hundreds of journalists, activists, academics, students, and artists have been coming together to build what you might call the New Girls Network, as opposed to the Old Boys Network, at the annual Women, Action, and the Media, or WAM, conference. The next WAM conference will be in Cambridge, Massachusetts, on March 27th through the 29th. Jacqueline Friedman is the program director of the Center for New Words, the group that organizes the WAM conference each year. She says the conference has a little something for everyone.
We have a number of sessions that are skills-building sessions, both for journalists about how to use the Freedom of Information Act, how to use Twitter, a conversation with editors, talking about women on the op-ed pages. We also have skills-building sessions for activists and people trying to get message out about PR and using social media and a number of different skill-building sessions like that. And then we have sessions about how to cover certain issues, why HIV is a feminist issue and why the feminist media should be covering it more, how to cover climate change, those sorts of sessions.
The conference kicks off with a keynote panel that will feature the voices of women reporting from global conflict zones.
So we have Peta Thornycroft, who's been covering conflict in Zimbabwe for decades. We have Huda Ahmed, who ran the Baghdad Bureau for McClatchy during parts of the war. And we have Jenny Cortez, who has been covering the conflict in Colombia for her entire career.
But the sessions at WAM aren't just focused on the tools of the trade. There are sessions discussing black women's invisibility in popular culture, media policy, stories about reproductive and sexual health, and the absence of women in political reporting.
It's a real big tent conference. Anyone who's concerned in gender justice in media should be at the conference. So if you are concerned that women's stories aren't being told or aren't being told accurately by the corporate media or even by the independent media, you should be at this conference. If you're concerned about, you know, how the media works and making it work better to get our stories covered, you should be at this conference.
To find out more or to register for the event, visit centerfornewwords.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
In the human cost of occupation in Iraq, multiple studies have estimated that over 1 million Iraqis have been killed since the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. The exact number of civilians killed is unknown, since neither the U.S. nor Iraqi governments do body counts of civilian casualties in the conflict. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Gender Blender at 6. Tomorrow's weather is some sun with highs around 50 and lows around 40.
The current time is 5:14. And now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Politicos and pundits on the right have resurrected an old bugaboo to hurl at Barack Obama's economic recovery efforts. Class war. Even New York Times columnist David Brooks, the soft-spoken but steadfast defender of America's corporate powers, has recently reached for this political cudgel to pound Obama's budget. He wails that the tax burden to finance such big initiatives as universal health care and energy independence is predicated on a class divide. Brooks expresses despair that, quote, no new burdens will fall on 95% of the American people, adding with a cluck of the tongue that all of the costs will be borne by the rich and all benefits redistributed downward. Let us all now give a collective hug to the poor put upon rich, who for the past 30 years have been grabbing practically all of the financial gains generated in our economy, while the vast majority of folks have seen their real incomes decline. Then let us point out to Brother Brooks that such things as health care for all and a booming green economy actually will be of great benefit to everyone, including the rich. Yet the Times columnist condemns promiscuous redistributionists who want to spread the wealth. with a straight face. He cries out for a conservative vision of, quote, a nation in which we're all in it together, in which burdens are shared broadly rather than simply inflicted on a small minority. What planet has this guy been on the last couple of decades? This small minority he weeps for is the same bunch of elites who created tax dodges, trade scams, deregulation fantasies, deunionization schemes, financial hustles, and other mechanisms to redistribute wealth from workaday families to them. This is Jim Hightower saying, yeah, it's about time the burden shifts upward. And I say it's about time the benefits of our economy become broadly shared. Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Ohio Teamsters pulled about $14 million out of KeyBank last week after the Cleveland-based bank failed to take action in response to workers' rights violations at Oak Harbor Freight Lines based in Auburn, Washington. KeyBank and its parent company, KeyCorp, are the primary lender to Oak Harbor Freight Lines and have failed to react to the company's new proposal to limit workers' rights. Oak Harbor employees in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho have been trying to negotiate a new contract with their employer since August 2007. The company's most recent proposal would permanently freeze pay for newly hired clerical staff. It would allow the company to arbitrarily fire clerical staff, permanently deny new warehouse workers access to health and welfare benefits. It would eliminate paid sick leave and limit health coverage. The new proposal would also freeze workers' pensions and retract health care coverage promised to retirees.
In response to the salmonella outbreak this year and the downed cow scandal last year, the U.S. Congress has proposed a national animal identification system. The system would require all farms in the country to purchase computer tracking equipment and implant all animals with radio frequency ID chips. The bill, known as the TRACE Act of 2009, which stands for Tracing and Recalling Agricultural Contamination Everywhere. But factory farms by large agribusiness firms would be exempt from the requirement. Groups advocating on behalf of family farmers claim that the new ID system would unfairly target small farmers and could put them out of business, and would not solve the problem of contamination in factory farms.
An Army reservist from Wisconsin who went AWOL to protest the war has agreed to return to Iraq after being threatened by his company commander. Army Specialist Christopher Walker refused to board a flight back to Iraq last month, saying that he no longer trusts his military leaders. He told the local media that he believes that soldiers are humans, not sacrificial animals. But now, after being threatened by his company commander, he has agreed to return to Iraq for the remaining 4 months of his unit's tour of duty. It is unknown what he was threatened with, but other soldiers who went AWOL to protest the war have served up to 2 years in military prison and received dishonorable discharges. Walker says he's still against the war, but the Army has the power to ruin his life.
A British military psychologist has admitted that the country has, quote, no idea how many Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. There is currently no accurate study of the size or scale of the problem, but top British military brass have spoken out recently about the government's failure to support veterans, particularly in the area of mental health. But in the United States, the problem could potentially be far greater than in Britain due to the high numbers of soldiers that have served in Iraq and Afghanistan. In the U.S. and Britain, there is no government agency set up to address the mental health issues of combat veterans. British psychologists point out that part of the problem is to get soldiers to admit that they need help, as they are instructed in the military to hide their emotions and reactions to the trauma of war.
Three demonstrators were arrested in Calgary, Canada today before a speech given by former U.S. President George W. Bush. One was dragged away shouting that he was trying to serve the former president with a citizen's arrest for war crimes. Bush was met by a barrage of shoes thrown by about 500 demonstrators. They were following the example of Iraqi journalist Montadar al-Zaidi, who was recently sentenced to 2 years in prison for throwing his shoes at George Bush in December. Bush was also hit with a lawsuit filed by a group of Canadian lawyers charging the former U.S. president with torture. Cable's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Gail Davidson, one of the lawyers filing the charges.
Can you talk about your case against George W. Bush?
No, we haven't actually filed a lawsuit against Mr. Bush this time. When he came in 2004, we attempted to start a criminal prosecution of him for aiding, abetting, and counseling torture at Abu Ghraib in Guantanamo. This time, Mr. Bush is not protected by head of state immunity, but we didn't take the step of laying any criminal charges against him for a number of reasons. What we did is we advised the Canadian government that under Canadian law, Mr. Bush, because of the allegations against him for creating, supervising, and directing torture that was widespread and long-term in various countries of the world, is an inadmissible person to Canada, and so he had to be barred from Canada.
And do you think that there is a Canadian court that would hear a case against George W. Bush?
Oh, sorry. Yes, there is a jurisdiction now in Canada to prosecute Mr. Bush because he's come here and triggered the jurisdiction of Canada. But under the enforcement of international law, there's a kind of a stepping stones of which country should prosecute first. And so obviously the first country that should prosecute Bush administration people for torture is the U.S. And certainly if a prosecution of Mr. Bush were mounted in Canada, it would be possible for somebody in the defense to say, well, this is premature because it hasn't yet been proven and established that the U.S. is not capable and willing of conducting that prosecution. And certainly, even though President Obama is saying, let's look forward and not look back and let's let bygones be bygones, there's many, many scholars, justice advocates, lawyers, judges in the U.S. who are working hard to put together proper briefs of evidence and to convince the authorities that proper investigations followed by proper prosecutions should be commenced by the American state. And so perhaps that will happen. So all I'm saying is it's early to say whether or not the Canadian jurisdiction to prosecute should properly be engaged, because we don't yet know whether the American one is going to be engaged.
Again, I've been speaking with Gail Davidson with Lawyers Against the War, based in Vancouver, Canada, and this is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
An international summit is currently underway in Sarajevo and is calling for the educational reform as the key to lasting world peace. Top peace negotiators and education experts joined representatives of governments and the United Nations at the unique summit to examine how quality education can be prioritized in conflict-affected countries. Nobel Peace Prize winners Desmond Tutu, Mairead McGuire, and Rigoberta Menchú addressed the conference. 32 other Nobel Prize winners have signed on to a statement calling for urgent action to implement quality education to help bring peace to conflict-affected countries.
Russia has announced that it plans to spend $140 billion upgrading its military over the next 2 years. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has said the spending plan comes partly in response to NATO's expansion near Russia's borders.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Post time today, the service of the International Middle East Media Centre, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, March 17th, 2009. The Israeli army injures a civilian in Gaza and kidnaps 16 civilians from the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. One Palestinian civilian was injured midday on Tuesday when Israeli naval boats opened fire on residents and fishermen gathered at the beach near Bet Laya in the central Gaza Strip. Doctors pronounced that one man suffered moderate wounds and was moved to a nearby hospital for treatment. In the West Bank, Israeli soldiers kidnapped 16 Palestinians from Ramallah district in central West Bank and in southern Hebron district during Monday night and Tuesday at dawn. Eyewitnesses reported that soldiers invaded villages near Ramallah where they broke into and searched dozens of homes before taking captive 9 residents. Also, troops invaded villages near Hebron and kidnapped several residents. In related news, Israeli soldiers invaded Atil near the northern West Bank city of Ramallah and conducted military searches of homes. Local sources in Atil reported that several military jeeps invaded the village, broke into and searched several homes. The residents were forced out of their homes whilst the soldiers searched them. In Jerusalem, bulldozers belonging to the Israeli municipality demolished a Palestinian-owned flat located in the Beit Zafafa neighborhood of the city. The flat is part of a 7-story high building owned by Abu Khalef, a Palestinian from Jerusalem. Israeli troops arrived in Beit Zafafa on Tuesday morning to surround the building, shortly after which troops forced everybody out and demolished the 7th floor. The Israeli municipality says that the flat was built without the necessary permission. The number of Palestinian-owned homes in Jerusalem that Israel states it intends to demolish has reached 179 since the start of 2009. Since Israel occupied the city of Jerusalem in 1967, the authorities have rarely given Palestinian residents permission to build homes. The Israeli government has continued to build Jewish settlements in and around Jerusalem and throughout the West Bank, an act which contravenes international law and all peace treaty agreements signed between Israel and the Palestinians since the 1993 Oslo Accords. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You've been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Centre, www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Mary Arthur and Ghazan Benora.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we are open to your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robert Barncord, Kyle Burris, and Caleb Sipala. Our engineer is Kyle Burris. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on the KABU website at kboo.fm. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Rebecca Ney. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein speaks with Bob Salinger of the Portland Audubon Society about his work to create a wake-free zone in the Holgate Channel and ban motorized craft from the neighboring Ross Island Lagoon. At 9, on Alternative Radio, author and independent political analyst Michael Parenti speaks on the hypocrisies of capitalism. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, news and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on The Food Show, hear Potato Talk, featuring a visit to an incredible edible local garden at Roosevelt High, where growing food unifies and nurtures youth. And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the Worker Run Collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Robert.
Good night, Rebecca.
From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Tuesday, March 17, 2009. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill respond after Mexico moves to raise tariffs on U.S. products. We'll go to the Gaza Strip, where poultry, once a staple food, has now become a luxurious commodity. And the outrage over AIG's bonuses continues. We'll hear why some Congress members blame the Obama administration. I'm Laura Bogado. Those stories after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Islamic law, known as Sharia, became the rule of the land in provincial Pakistan today. Mazur Hussein reports from Islamabad.
Four Taliban-backed Sharia courts began functioning in Sawat, with powers to impose strict sentences in accordance with Islamic jurisprudence, including flogging, chopping of hands, and even beheading without the right to appeal. Last month, when the Taliban and Pakistan signed a ceasefire to end the year-old war in which 1,000 people died, scores of schools were destroyed, and many more fled the scenic valley, the Taliban demanded Sharia, or Islamic courts, in the region. Today, moderate Islamic leader Sufi Muhammad, who brokered the ceasefire, asked civil judges not to come to their courts, saying all cases would now be taken up by the qazis or Islamic judges. The ceasefire agreement was criticized by the United States and liberals in Pakistan as an act of capitulation to the Taliban. But the government in Islamabad says fighting alone would not stop the insurgency. Similar courts may spread out to neighboring Taliban-controlled districts. Masroor Hussain, Free Speech Radio News, Islamabad.
The Commerce Department today released February's figures on housing starts, or residential building construction that began during the month, revealing a dramatic increase. After the longest stretch of declines in nearly 20 years, building began on 22% more condominiums, townhomes, and apartments than during the previous month. Teachers from Argentina's major unions went on strike in the nation's capital today. Marie Trigona is in Buenos Aires.
Classrooms were empty in Buenos Aires today. Teachers are on a 48-hour strike demanding a salary increase and better conditions for schools. As a result, more than 600,000 students missed class. In a massive rally in front of City Hall, teachers wore white school smocks, criticizing the government for allowing the educational system to deteriorate. Cecilia Martinez, a public school teacher, explains that today's protest was in defense of access to adequate education.
Budgets have been cut, infrastructure inside schools hasn't been maintained, the salaries for teachers are so low that there aren't as many teachers. Public schools are closing. Education is really a basic right.
Public health care workers joined the rally, holding their own 24-hour strike in public hospitals in the capital city. This is the first major strike of 2009. As the financial crisis grips Argentina, the government has begun to cut public spending budgets. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
A federal court today refused to overturn a lower court decision requiring that the Defense Department make pictures of detainees being abused in Iraq and Afghanistan public. The ACLU filed a Freedom of Information request for the photos in 2003. The Bush administration refused to comply, citing potential public outrage. The administration also claimed that the release of the photos would violate their responsibilities to detainees under the Geneva Conventions. The Obama administration has 90 days to appeal to the Supreme Court if it chooses to challenge the decision. The Pope arrived in Cameroon today on his first papal visit to Africa. On the way, he took up the issue of Africans and HIV, noting that the pandemic is a tragedy, but adding that he does not support the distribution of condoms. Further, he said that condoms aggravate the problem. Some 22 million people living in sub-Saharan Africa are infected with the virus. A group of 16 prominent international figures called on the UN yesterday to investigate possible Geneva Convention violations during recent fighting in the Gaza Strip. Ghassan Banoura is in Ramallah.
During Israel's latest 22-day war in Gaza, at least 7,000 Palestinians were hurt as the Israeli army shelled civilian areas and used internationally banned weapons against the civilians. In a letter signed by Richard Goldstone, prosecutor in two criminal courts on war crimes in Yugoslavia and Rwanda, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, among others, the authors say that the events in Gaza shocked them to the core. The signatories asked that the investigation encompasses all parties to the Gaza conflict. The letter was endorsed by Amnesty International and was sent to the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and the UN Security Council. They added that a criminal investigation is called for due to sharp violations of international law and the principles of human rights, and that justice must be achieved for the residents of the Gaza Strip before moving towards peace in the Middle East. For FSRN and IMEMC.org, this is Ghassan Banoura.
Madagascar's President Ravalo Manan handed over power of the Indian Ocean island today, but said he would only cede control to the military. However, opposition leader Andry Rajoelina has declared himself head of a transitional government. Rajoelina says the president undercut democracy and squandered public monies, while Ravalo Manan says the opposition seeks to oust him unconstitutionally. The move leaves Madagascar's position in the African Union uncertain, as coups or unconstitutional changes of government are cause for automatic suspension. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
Outrage over bonuses given to AIG traders continues for another day on Capitol Hill. Lawmakers are responding with a whirlwind of ideas to get the taxpayers' money back. As Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports, some members of Congress also blame the Obama administration.
Chuck Grassley, top Republican on the Senate Finance Committee, had some of the harshest words for the executives at AIG.
Corporate America needs an ethic like they have in Japan, where corporate executives take responsibility for what they're doing and apologize to the people of Japan. We don't have that in this country, and we ought to have it.
That Japanese ethic referenced by Grassley is suicide. Anger flooded the halls of Congress, which is on the hook for approving $170 billion for AIG. As Grassley expressed, much of that anger is directed at the company. Democrats are asking AIG to renegotiate those contracts that include the bonuses. If AIG refuses, Democrats say they will devise a plan to tax those bonuses more than 90%. New York Senator Charles Schumer.
So that it's returned to its rightful owners, the taxpayers. So for those of you who are getting these bonuses, be forewarned, you will not be getting to keep them.
Republicans are reluctant to opine on the Democrats' tax proposal, but top Senate Republican Mitch McConnell says the Obama administration has dropped the ball.
The government has been heavily involved in AIG for some months now. It's shocking that the administration would come to us now and act surprised about these contracts. Why didn't they ask the question 2 weeks ago before they gave them $30 billion?
Because without this money, these bonuses could not have been paid.
Republican Senator John Ensign of Nevada.
So that's why we need to make sure that there's more accountability here, more transparency. We need to know, were those discussions even had? And if not, why weren't they?
AIG paid out $165 million worth of bonuses to derivative traders, traders of credit default swaps, which are blamed for AIG's need for government rescue. Chair of the Financial Services Committee, Barney Frank, says the U.S. should start acting like owners of the company and take AIG to court to dissolve those contracts. U.S. taxpayers own 80% of the firm. Republican Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama is questioning Secretary Geithner's competence. President Obama said he has asked the Treasury Department to see what can be done to break the contracts.
In the last 6 months, AIG has received substantial sums from the U.S. Treasury. And I've asked Secretary Geithner to use that leverage and pursue every single legal avenue to block these bonuses.
President Obama outlined restrictions on executive compensation last month. Those guidelines have not yet been completed. Democrats took out a provision of the stimulus package that would have imposed retroactive limits on executive compensation. Those would have applied to this set of AIG bonuses. But that amendment was stripped from the bill and was replaced with a more lenient restriction, which applied for future bonuses only. Thomas Ferguson, professor at the University of Massachusetts Boston, says the government has the power to act. He also says Congress must do its oversight.
This is a job for a congressional committee. These guys have to get off their dime and do some actual investigating, and they have to put people under oath when they do it.
Labor unions and consumer advocates are planning to protest outside AIG and hundreds of banks across the country Thursday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Mexico is increasing tariffs on some 90 U.S. products after Congress canceled a controversial NAFTA program this year. Before it was revoked as part of the Omnibus Appropriations Bill, the program allowed Mexican truckers to drive goods into the United States. Peter Granitz has more from Washington, where lawmakers are weighing in.
The Mexican government says the tariffs won't be placed on staple products like rice, corn, wheat, and meat, but they could still have far-reaching effects. According to Mexican Foreign Minister Gerardo Reyes Mateos, the tariffs will cost the U.S. more than $2.4 billion. He said the United States violated the NAFTA treaty by removing the program and is just protecting its own interests. The amendment canceling the program was placed in last week's omnibus appropriations bill. Senator Debbie Stabenow supported it. She says that she doesn't support the new tariffs, but that doesn't mean there's nothing to learn from it.
When other states don't like something that we have done where they perceive it to be unfair, they react quickly. In this country, we react incredibly slowly, if at all. And so I think it should remind us that trade enforcement is something we should be more aggressive on.
The Democrat represents Michigan, a state with high shipping interests. She says the provision will bolster the U.S. trucking industry. Much like any fair trade debate, reactions split along party lines. Democrats supported the amendment eliminating the pilot program, while Republicans denounced its removal. Republican Mel Martinez sits on the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation.
It was a terrible mistake for us in the omnibus bill to include the protectionist policies that violate NAFTA. And this is an anticipated response by Mexico. The United States needs to be very cautious not to start a trade war at a time of tremendous international financial distress.
The goal of the program was to test whether Mexican trucks were safe enough to travel on U.S. roads and highways. Some public advocacy groups opposed the program, saying it wasn't a test at all, just an opportunity for more business to cross the border. Joan Claybrook is with Public Citizen, a D.C.-based group that advocates for consumer rights and road safety. She says not only was the pilot program a farce, but it didn't provide accurate data on rig safety.
This has been an issue for a number of years between the Congress primarily and the Mexican government, because the Mexican government does not have the same alcohol and drug testing procedures that we have, or the hours of service requirements, the limit on the number of hours of service. Even though they're too long in the United States, they're longer in Mexico.
She echoed an argument of both congressional Democrats and the Teamsters Union. Mexican trucks are too dangerous for commerce in the U.S. The Teamsters applauded the cancellation of the pilot program. Senator John Kyle says the pilot program didn't allow dangerous trucks in the road. The Arizona Republican says canceling this program eliminates free trade, and both countries may need to slash jobs.
Look at what the Mexican government just did in retaliation. Free trade benefits both countries by definition. It's like when you go to the store and buy something, it benefits you, it benefits the store.
Kyle says the tariff shouldn't surprise anyone because preventing Mexican drivers access to U.S. roads harms the Mexican economy. Lawmakers from both parties have indicated it's an issue beyond Congress, and the White House may need to intervene. Peter Granitz, FSRN, Washington.
There's a continuing shortage of cooking gas in Gaza due to Israel's border closures, but there isn't always enough staple ingredients to cook in the pot. At least seven major poultry farms were destroyed during Israel's recent attack on Gaza, and as FSRN's Rami Almagari reports, that's made poultry a scarce and unaffordable luxury for most of the territory's 1.5 million residents.
At the Al-Nusayrat refugee camp market in central Gaza, chicken now costs about $4 a kilo, Even before Israel's 3-week invasion of Gaza at the beginning of 2009, prices for chicken had doubled because of the border closures. But during the Israeli attacks, poultry farms were destroyed. The price for chicken has now risen by almost 70%, according to the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics. The average household size in Gaza is 7, with an average daily income of $2.5. Such a fact has made it difficult for these households to buy chicken, a staple food for many in Gaza. Om Amr is the head of a 14-member family. Over the weekend, she was trying to find a smaller chicken at the local market.
After the Furqan war, all farms were hit. And there's a siege. Actually, there are many reasons. I used to buy one chicken for me and my daughter, two for my nieces, and two for my son's family. Now I can only afford 3 chickens, and this is the first time I've bought any in the last 3 weeks.
It's not only the residents of the Nusayrat refugee camp who cannot afford chicken, but also those living in the most urban neighborhood of Gaza City, Al Rimal. Marwan Al Sawafiri is the owner of a large chicken store.
The richest people who used to buy 20 chickens to keep in their freezers come now to buy 2 chickens, while others have turned to frozen food stores. There is no selling. I used to sell 300 to 400 chickens a day, and now I can hardly sell 40 chickens. Yesterday I sold 2 chickens for $30, and this is unbelievable.
The lack of chicken has also affected other sectors in Gaza, mainly restaurants and food delivery stores. The Beirut food delivery store on Al Nasser Street in Gaza City, which has been in business for 8 years, has felt the impact of the shortages. Yahya Al Khatib is the owner of the store.
I'm located in Gaza City, but in order to find chicken for my customers, I must tour all the regions of the Gaza Strip, like Nusayrat, Maghazi, Al Baraj, or even Khan Yunis. It's the first time we've faced a crisis. It's true that we've gone through many price decreases and increases, but you don't know what's going on nowadays, whether it's lack of gas, closed borders, or lack of animal feed. This has really impacted us.
The lack of chicken and other food high in a protein could affect the health of Gazans. Healthcare organizations in Gaza warn of the impact of the Israeli blockade on the region with respect to nutrition. Dr. Adnan Al-Uhaidi is the clinical director of the Human Land Benevolent Society for Family Healthcare in Gaza.
Many nutritional disorders were being discovered, and we noticed during the clinical practice and also during the surveys, as well as during the daily nutritional assessment of children who are followed by us, that qualitative and the quantitative increase in malnutrition is noticeably increasing, and there are many alarming figures that can project this problem. And nowadays we witness a multi-sectoral form of malnutrition, including adults and all other age groups among Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
Right, Fatouh, chief of the Palestinian Committee for the Coordination of Goods Entry into Gaza, told Afasaran that despite the fact that Israel allows dozens of trucks loaded with food and aid into the Strip on a daily basis, it is not enough to meet basic needs. Fatouh adds that there are many items that are still lacking here, as Israel only reopened one of 7 crossings during 6 days of the week. He adds even goods that do enter are less essential, such as diapers, tissues, or fruits. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Al-Maghari in Gaza.
As the 6th anniversary of the start of the Iraq War approaches, U.S., British, and German vets testified about their service in Iraq and Afghanistan this weekend at Winter Soldier Europe in Freiburg. Organized by Iraq Veterans Against the War, the vets made their eyewitness accounts known to the public. One of those vets is the UK's Martin Weber. Weber served in Northern Ireland, Sierra Leone, and Iraq, and was arrested after filming the beating of Iraqis by British soldiers. Rogers in 2004. He was never charged and left the Army afterward. Weber talked about what he's had to do to cope with post-traumatic stress disorder and what it's like to return to civilian life after so much war.
Marriage fell apart, ended up being homeless. My mum and dad didn't know that I was homeless. So it's a pride thing, and I think you'll agree with me on this, that, you know, you're a soldier, you don't want to admit that you've screwed up. You know, I had at one point I had a house in Spain, a house in England, I had my own bought car, and then all of a sudden I had nothing, and it was all taken away from me, and I was like, what if I, you know, everything had just gone wrong, and I just thought, God, I've got to change, or I've got to try and I was changing. It was just PTSD is a form of purging out all the demons in your system. And I call it like the quickening off Highlander film. You're going through the quickening. And it's almost, you should be proud that you've got PTSD. Not, you're questioning what had happened. And you, there is a way forward. You will get through it. And like, there's a guy I met yesterday that I can see, he's what I was like a year ago. And I'm now getting my confidence back, building on my life. I've got so many plans for the future, and I'm feeling positive again. And we understand that the military are doing what they're doing, and we might not all agree with it, but those soldiers, we can't blame the soldiers. Soldiers have got to wake up in their own time. A lot of them are trapped within the military system with a pension or anything like that, and they've got families to feed. And this is the thing, you know, is the government are playing on that. And my mission now with Voices of War is to go to the government, look, what you're spending at the moment on veterans with PTSD is abysmal. You know, it's almost a joke. I mean, these men serve for their country. They fight for their country and their queen, and they're the most honourable men you ever meet. I mean, these guys will buy you a drink in a pub. They'll fight to the death for you. And to then to just go, we're going to offset 42.5 million is what they've offset. Well, I've got also a figure here for what they're spending at the moment on alcohol abuse and drug abuse in the country, and it's up to 300 million. I mean, if you're going to have these wars, then you offset the money to repair the damage on the soldiers that are damaged.
Martin Weber's been working on a film called Diary of a Disgraced Soldier. It's scheduled for release this summer. Weber is one of several vets who testified at Winter Soldier Europe. You can see and hear more testimony at ivaw.org. 30 years after the genocide, Cambodia is still one of the poorest nations in Southeast Asia, where 35% of the population lives on less than half a dollar a day. Despite, or maybe because of its poverty, the country remains a favorite destination for pedophiles. A U.S. tourist and a French tourist were both arrested this month on sexual abuse charges, and last year a California man was handed over to the U.S. Department of Justice and tried and convicted on 7 felony charges in San Francisco. He's now serving more than a 200-year sentence. FSRN's Courtiev Him met a young girl in Phnom Penh who was one of the 7 survivors sexually abused by the California tourist.
Inside a room decorated by toys and drawings on the wall, a group of female students are studying English. This is not a traditional school. This is a shelter for girls who have been trafficked and sexually assaulted by foreign tourists. Since 2006, the non-government organization AKAPE has been providing security and consulting to the survivors of pedophile tourism. One of them, trafficked, is a 13-year-old girl from Kandal province. She was trafficked and raped by an American tourist 3 years ago when she was 10 years old.
I was a child at that time. I'm from a very poor family. We didn't have a home to stay in, and there was no money for my education and not enough food to eat. Then my mother told me to follow a lady who promised to support my education in Phnom Penh and to support my family.
Saipik says, in less than a year's time, she was forced to have sex every day.
Early in the morning, I do the housework and clean up, and then I go to school. In the afternoon, I clean the house again, and in the evening, I have dinner. Each night, I'm forced to render sexual services to him. Yes, every day.
Eventually, with the help of youth advocates, Sripit came to live in an Agape school. Meanwhile, local police found and arrested the American offender, a former Marine captain named Michael Joseph Pipe, who was working as a teacher. Pipe was deported and eventually tried and convicted in a San Francisco federal court. Sripit was not the only survivor of this California tourist. At the time of Pipe's arrest in Phnom Penh, three girls less than 10 years old were also in his custody. And Michael Pipe is not the only pedophile arrested. So far, 84 offenders are arrested since 2003, whose nationality includes many Western countries, Japan and China. A well-entrenched network of local agents recruits and supplies children to the pedophile who visit Cambodia. 20 local agents also are arrested in last 5 years. These Cambodian agents are at large in all tourist places like Phnom Penh, Siem Reap, and Sihanoukville. Somlien Sela is the country director of the Action Pour Les Enfants, a French organization helping the police to identify suspected pedophiles.
There are several reasons contributing to this increase of sex offender. First, it could be that there are still children available for sex in exchange of money. Children are in favor of money. This is a problem of poverty. Second reason, I think we have not done enough yet in terms of providing information to the police. And the other reason could be Cambodia is still seen as a destination for child sex, while the other country in Asia or in other country have been seriously taking the fight against sexual exploitation.
Somlien Sela says in the year 2008, there were about 15 arrests of foreign pedophiles, and this year police arrested 6 pedophiles.
The problem is still at a concerning level here. There is much left to do, and the government should improve their capacity and effort to deal with this problem, because as I said, Cambodia is still a country that is weaker in terms of fighting against sexual exploitation with lack of resources to deal with this problem.
Back in the shelter, Sripit says she regrets her experience but hopes nothing similar happens to any other child.
I don't blame anybody, my parents, the agent, or even myself, because it will help nothing. But I just want to say one thing. I want parents not to sell their children to sexual service for money, regardless of how poor they are. I want them to live and work in a better way. Even being a beggar is better. Personally, I really want to live with my poor family instead of doing sexual service work.
She says she will work hard with her study here at Agape and will not go back home. For Prestige Radio News, this Khotit Him in Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. We're supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback by dropping us an email to comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Rose Katabchi and Oscar Hernandez. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.
Good evening, everybody. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. The time is now just 25 seconds past 6 o'clock. Coming up next is Gender Blender with Rebecca Nay and Jake Anderson Mitchell. But for now, let's listen to some announcements.
Would you like to help KABU Community Radio grow and prosper? Do you have an interest in nonprofit finances and operations? We have a job opening for finance coordinator. This is a 30-hour per week position with full benefits, including medical. Starting pay is $18 to $22 per hour. You will work with staff, volunteers, and CPAs to support KABU through account management, financial analysis, and reporting. For a full description, please visit kabu.fm/employment. Resume, cover letter, and application are required. If you have any questions, please email Station Manager Arthur Davis at manager@kabu.org. The deadline for applications is Friday, March 20th, 5 p.m. We look forward to hearing from you.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay and Lesbian Community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. For more information, you can call 503-230-7701 or you can visit them on the web at www.pdxgayyellowpages.com.
This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net.
I had a sex education without a word for my gender. All these half-hearted tries just put them in a blender.
From the studios of KABU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Gender Blender with your hosts, Rebecca Ney
and Jacob Anderson Mitchell.
There's no specific job only a woman can do, and there's no specific job only a man can do. They're pretty much interchangeable.
In the United States, there are certain jobs in the military where only men are permitted to do the job.
Well, typically speaking, it seems like there's a lot more women secretaries. I'm not sure that I've ever met a man secretary. It seems like in today's world, that's kind of one of the few that I've seen that where only women have been involved. Nurses is typically one of those things that I think I'm happy to say that, you know, we're getting closer to a world where that's becoming less of an issue. It still is, obviously, but
I can't think of any jobs at the top of my head that only a woman could do.
There are probably some really heavy construction jobs that I would guess only a man could do. I don't otherwise think that there are many things. I think it's only based on physical limitations, certainly not mental or intellectual limitations or differences.
Oh, I'm no stripper. I mean, I don't think there's just a job that just men can do nowadays. It's gotten it's evened out quite a bit.
Sperm donor?
Yeah, male porn star?
Again, I'm going to have to go with the female stripper. That's all I got.
You just heard from ordinary Portlanders as they responded to questions of what jobs only men and women could perform. Thank you for tuning in to Gender Blender. My name is Rebecca Ney.
This is Jacob Anderson Mitchell.
And we have a great show for you tonight. As you may have guessed, we will be talking about employment issues and how our gender identity impacts issues such as finding a job, how much we get paid, and how we are treated on the job. Tonight we'll hear from Teresa Mitchell, a fellow KABU volunteer who will share her experiences undergoing a gender transition while working as a TriMet bus driver. We will also hear from Kristen Schilt, who did a study on the workplace experience of transgender people. Joining us later in the program will be Diego Sanchez. Diego is Congressman Barney Frank's senior policy advisor. We'll be discussing issues surrounding the Employment Non-Discrimination Act and how Diego, as a trans man, can help Congressman Franks reverse his past position of advocating the exclusion of trans people from this legislation. We hope you enjoy the show.
My name is Rebecca Ney, and I'm joined here by Teresa Mitchell.
Hi.
Hi, Teresa. Teresa is the host of Press Watch, which is a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program.
Easy for you to say.
Yes. I said it without stumbling. It airs every Thursday morning from 9 to 9:30 a.m. She has also self-published a book called Jesus, a parody of the popular Left Behind series. Teresa, thank you for joining me on Gender Blender.
It's my pleasure.
Our topic today is gender in the workplace. We're going to be talking about your experiences working for TriMet. But before we do that, tell me, Teresa, just a little bit about who you are. Obviously, a trans woman is one of your many identities, like we all have many identities. So since we're going to talk about gender in the workplace, I guess we could start with, when did you transition?
That was April 2001 is when I changed my name and my gender officially.
And you were working for TriMet at the time you transitioned, correct?
Yes. I had been working for them for 2 years at that point.
Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences when you started with TriMet and how you were treated as an employee before your transition?
Well, it's a union job, and it's the best job I've had in that sense. You certainly get more respect as a union worker. Driving a bus for TriMet comes with a package of union wages and benefits. It helps that there's a contract and you know the rules in advance and they're set out. And advancement accrues according to seniority, which may have its problems. But it's very transparent. And I found that transparency is it's hard to overrate.
What is the percentage of male versus female drivers?
Well, you had me there. I'd say it's preponderance of male, but that could be just my experience working out of the garage I work out of. Seems to be mostly men. Maybe there's a third woman.
Can you tell us a little bit about the process you went through transitioning on the job? Because I know for me that was one of the scariest things I ever did.
Well, it wasn't so scary for me. I wrote them a letter. I told them what I was doing and why. And asked to have a meeting with them, and they were forthcoming with the meeting, and very correct in most ways. I seemed to stump them when I asked them for a bathroom, because I explained that, just given the context there, I would say that most TriMet drivers are to the right of the general population in terms of social mores, or however you want to define that, a little conservative. And so I wanted a place where I could use restroom, change clothes, whatever, and not endanger myself by being in the men's room and not freak out the women by going into their bathroom at a time which I was, you know, suddenly changing gender, and I thought it would be rather disruptive to them. And so what they did was they had bathrooms in the front of the facility. It was a rather large facility, a center garage, and they made them unisex and put latches on them. And it worked well enough. And so I thought, well, you know, that was a good start. What I didn't realize when I was talking to them at first was that that was 2001, and things had advanced by that point enough that the insurance that I had, which is at that time Blue Cross, would normally have covered my gender transition had they not purposefully excluded it. And so I told them at the time, well, I understand that insurance doesn't cover transition, so I won't be asking for surgery. But that was, as it turns out, that was predicated on my assumption and not on the facts.
Yeah, I know a lot of insurance plans nowadays, which, you know, I guess for me as a trans person as well, it's humbling to know how much recognition we get in corporate insurance plans, considering how few of us there are. It seems like just about every insurance plan that I've seen specifically mentions something about sexual reassignment surgery. Now, we know that transition is more than surgery for most of us. What about, like, some of the other medical things that are involved in a gender transition, like hormones and counseling and what have you?
Well, TriMet's exclusion policy excludes everything having to do with transitioning gender.
Wow.
However, there has been a sort of unspoken allowance and which the medical community engages in, and I suppose the employer chooses not to prosecute, that my medical providers have just decided to, well, once I changed my gender to female, it was certainly easier to code treatments. I mean, since I am legally female, then I am given what is called hormone replacement therapy, which is, you know, doesn't say anything about gender transition. Nevertheless, I have a prescribed patch on me right now, and started using hormones, prescribed hormones, around that time.
It's interesting you mention that, because when I was working for Wells Fargo, the insurance policy specifically mentioned the surgery, but it didn't really mention anything else. So my doctor took advantage of that. When she prescribed me the hormones, she didn't specifically encode it with any kind of, like, transgender-type code. I don't even know if that exists, and I don't understand the whole medical billing terminology. But I think that's what a lot of progressive doctors are doing with their transgender clients, is just kind of changing how it's encoded and how it's billed to the insurance companies.
My doctor and other doctors that I've encountered have been very compassionate about that, and they seem to realize that the society generally is not up to speed compared to the medical community in recognizing transgenderism as a medical condition.
Let's talk a little bit more about your experiences at TriMet, being a bus driver. How did things change in regards to how you were treated?
Well, there was a ferocious and angry resistance across the board at first. Although I would say that management was rather careful to be correct. People were upset. Drivers were upset. I will say, though, that drivers, by and large, my fellow workers, were restrained in their reaction. Got the occasional comment, but really not all that much. Just this morning, a station agent, who I'm pretty sure is gay, not that that has to do with anything, called me he. And, you know, I've been working there 8 years in transition now. So it's like I haven't made any progress with this person. And that would not be the only one. It was the public that really gave me hell for it. And when I first transitioned, of course, I was not capable of modulating my voice. I was experimenting with it. I had a heck of a time.
You know what that's like.
Yeah. I use a different voice when I'm on the bus because of the public. I'm more careful than I am on the air or with my friends, because I realize that the general public, and it's a general statement, the general public simply is not ready for someone who is bending gender. When I first tried, I was quite clumsy and didn't know how to use makeup, couldn't get my stubble down. I use a voice now on the microphone on the bus, which is, I wouldn't say it's quite feminine, but it's a little bit masked. And it's actually, because of my inhibitions, it's a little difficult to replicate, except on the bus microphone. And I'll try a little bit Burnside and 20th, just trying to be a little more sing-song, a little less baritone. I can scarcely imitate myself. That is the degree of inhibition. But I would say that the inhibition that I'm feeling now is a reaction to that ferocious public reaction, which expressed itself in many ways. Everything from insults to horror to confrontations, and including violent confrontations, spitting, shoving, threats of death, that sort of thing. And at first, especially, I experienced that on a daily and hourly basis.
When you were experiencing this, I would assume you took your concerns to TriMet. What was their response?
Well, I'd better be careful in responding to you. So let me think about that. They told me to fill out a card relating to incidents. They had a special form called a yellow card, and I filled out the yellow card. And it didn't feel like I was getting much of a response from the people in charge of that. This was around 2001, I'm talking about, 2002, 2003, and eventually gave up filling out the yellow cards because at first there was no response forthcoming. That has changed in recent years. My experience on the bus has changed also greatly in recent years. I've certainly learned to pass much better than I did before, much of that having to do not just with clothing, of course, but with mannerisms. I'm not confronted constantly. Actually, I'm not exactly caught by surprise when, you know, once every couple of days or so someone will make some remark, but I'm not confronted with the fury that I was experiencing in say, 2002 or 2003.
You've had some public spats.
Yes.
With TriMet. Do you mind talking about those?
No, don't mind talking about it. I have, at one point, I engaged a lawyer and considered suing them over what I considered to be violation of city code and discrimination when I discovered, as I said before, that they were actively prohibiting my obtaining surgery. The American Medical Association came out last year with a statement, which was generally circulated and put out in the press, that it was not only counterproductive but a waste of money to deny needed services to transgendered women and men.
That's the major one that you went public with?
That's the big thing for me, because it is a public contact job, a constant public contact job, and the reaction to my appearance is ferocious. I do have difficulty presenting as a woman, as I said, with my voice, and this goes back to so many confrontations in which I was actually just conditioned to feel fear and shame about transitioning. I feel that all of that, well, maybe not all of it, but a good deal of it could have been avoided if TriMet had been more cooperative, if I had been able to get more voice coaching, especially crucially as I began trying to change the way I sounded, if I had been able to get facial feminization or at least effective beard removal. I've had something like 20 laser treatments, and it's not as effective as other epilating treatments.
I'm going to be the devil's advocate here, more specifically for the benefit of our listeners that maybe just don't quite get the whole transgender experience and why it's necessary. Why were you asking all of these things from TriMet as far as help with your voice, help with some of the medical treatments that you needed to pass and perform successfully on your job? Do you mind talking about that? Why is that necessary?
Well, that's necessary because it is my nature to need to present as a woman. And why that happens is, of course, complex and gets into psychoneuroendocrinology, which is a relatively new field, but is not an unstudied or unheard of field. And as I've mentioned, the standard and accepted medical practice for someone who needs to present as female but who presents as male, is to allow that person to present as female, thereby allowing the relief of the tension which is created by the transgenderism within the individual, but also allowing that person to escape the sort of constant public punishment that I was experiencing at the time. And what I add into the mix, generally speaking, in my effort to convince people that this is an actual medical condition, I don't feel like I should have to do this, but just to add to it, I think that my body was poisoned by diethylstilbestrol when I was in my mother's womb. Diethylstilbestrol, DES, is a powerful hormone, a replacement for estrogen, which is used, among other things, to help pregnant women avoid miscarriages. It's not considered to be effective for that, and has a great many other side effects, T-shaped uteruses in women. I believe in my case, it caused me to present as male. Or I could turn that coin on its other side and say on the obverse, it caused me to feel that I was female.
So needless to say, your transition was necessary to your personal well-being and health. Getting help from your employer was going to help your performance and really safety on the job.
Certainly. I mean, I could turn that on its other side as well and say the only reason that it's not considered is because it's not considered to be a legitimate position. And the real way that I assume management, but certainly a great many people think about transgenderism, is that it is a morally perverted lifestyle choice. And we do not say that about other conditions. For example, if I had broken my leg, I would have a condition of a broken leg, and people would not be counseling me against going into the hospital to have my leg set, saying that it would be expensive and pointless, because it would be automatically considered a legitimate choice. And whereas as I said, the medical community has made it quite clear that to the extent they understand this condition, they know it's treatment and it's simply medical science, the society wants to resist it and say, no, you are perverted, you must pay for this. And part of the payment that I must pay and that I have paid is to have the public ferociously condition me into a cowed individual, frankly. That's why my voice sounds like this. I can talk much more like a woman than this.
Well, that gets really to me into the whole area of just gender roles in general, because we know that society expects different things from men and women. Do you mind sharing some stories about how you've been treated differently, not only as a transgender woman, but as a woman in general working for TriMet?
Well, I guess I could contrast that with speaking on the radio. My voice often sounds male, generally sounds male, and so I'm able to express myself on the radio and nothing changes. But in person-to-person relations, I find that a great deal changes. A lot of it is funny. For example, I find that if people are reading me as a woman, then they will suddenly leap to my aid, even in efforts that one would consider in a male simply part of their professional purview. Even something as simple as making a corner with the bus, men will leap out to the side of the bus and say, "Oh, I think you've got a little more room there," even if it's a corner that I take every day and have for years. And I find that it's very true that men tend to speak over women and don't listen to them in the same way. And so I've found that amusing at times.
I've been speaking with Teresa Mitchell, the host of Press Watch. Our topic has been gender in the workplace, and she's been sharing her experiences with TriMet. Teresa, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Rebecca.
This is Jacob Anderson Mitchell. You've been listening to Gender Blender. We've been talking to Teresa Mitchell. And yesterday I had the pleasure of speaking with Kristen Schultz, who co-authored a recent study on the impact of gender transition on workplace experiences. But before we get to that, we're going to listen to the lottery song by folk singing trans woman named Molly Brennett from her incredible album, Singer Shine Your Light.
Lottery. What if we
You are listening to Gender Blender on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland. My name is Rebecca Ney, and I'm here with
Jacob Anderson Minchell.
And you've been listening to the lottery song
by Naomi Brennett.
Yay. And I believe we've got a phone caller, Jessica. You are on the air on Gender Blender.
Hi.
Jessica, I believe I know you from way back when, in another time, in another place.
Another life.
In another life. Almost another life. But I like to try and keep them all connected somewhat. Thank you for calling.
I know. I just wanted to call and just say I'm proud of you and what a great job you're doing.
Well, thank
you.
This
is awesome.
And just for the benefit of our listeners, I went to high school with Jessica, and this is the first time I believe I've spoken with her since high school, so this is kind of exciting.
It is.
And we've got a 20...
And we won't say how old or long ago that was.
Yeah. All I know is we've got a 20-year reunion coming up, and I'm like, oh my gosh, not a 20-year reunion. So thank you for calling.
No kidding. So, wow, that's really cool.
Well, what do you think so far about the show? Do you have any thoughts?
I actually haven't been listening because we've been doing dinner.
That's way more important.
Transformers, and that's really loud, and you can't hear anything over them anyways.
There we go.
Well, we're kind of Transformers here ourselves.
Very much so. Thank you for calling, Jessica. We appreciate that.
Okay, and I just wanted to keep up the good work, and I'm proud of you, and we got to get together soon.
We do. We'll talk.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. So, as I said earlier, I had the privilege of speaking to Professor Christian Schultz, who has studied the impact transitioning has on salaries. We're going to go to that interview that was yesterday.
Why don't you tell us about the article that you co-authored, Before and After Gender Transition, Human Capital and Workplace Experiences?
Sure. My general research is on the experiences of transgender men in the workplace, and it's mainly an interview study comparing trans men in Texas and California. And as part of that research, I wanted to look at differences between trans men and trans women in the workplace, because, you know, we often speak of transgender as this kind of monolithic term, but it became very clear early on in my research that trans men had very different experiences at work than trans women. And this survey that I did with Matt Wiswall, who's an economist at NYU, was a way to really try to put some numbers behind that. I mean, it was something that I had documented sort of ethnographically, but I wanted to really look at what happens in salaries before and after transition. And so we actually did a survey. We went to several different transgender conferences across the country and had people fill out a survey and then looked at the numbers. And you know, what we found was that there was a very clear difference, that transgender women on average lost about $12 an hour when they went from being seen socially as men at work to being seen as women at work.
In fact, you showed that male to female transgender, so transgender women workers, their pay actually fell by nearly a third. Is that right?
Right. And what was interesting about that to me is, I mean, there's a lot of problems with going to transgender conferences to get a sample. You tend to get a kind of class bias. I mean, you're more likely to get people who are middle class. And we did try to mix it up a little bit by going to conferences that were free as well as those where you had to pay money. But the trans women who were in our study had more what we might call human capital on average than the average American man or American woman. So they had more workplace experience, they had more education, and yet they still had this kind of loss.
Right, and that's the, for those people who don't know what human capital is.
So the education, work skills, work experience, what you kind of invest into your workplace life. And that's really one of the biggest theories about why there's gender discrimination in the workplace, or why we see unequal patterns at work between men and women, is the idea that men invest more in their human capital and women, you know, invest more in their family. So it's just almost like a personal choice kind of argument.
Right.
And what we were really interested in was really looking at, does that theory make sense? And, you know, if that theory made sense, then you shouldn't see any difference in your workplace experience if you had, you know, this great amount of accumulated human capital. But in fact, you know, there was a clear difference.
Right. And you contend that the sort of greater support for becoming a man at work stems from two different sources. Can you talk about those?
Part of it comes from, and I mean, this is really what I've determined in my own work, that in addition to interviewing trans men, I also interviewed their coworkers. And part of the support, I think, comes from there's just more cultural justification that people have about why someone they see as a woman would want to be a man. I mean, even though I've never in my life encountered a trans man who says, oh, I just want to become a man because you get treated better, that's what people assume. And so coworkers and employers assume, well, you're just trying to get male privileges, it's often framed. And that makes sort of cultural sense to people, whereas someone who's working as a man who wants to become a woman is viewed with more suspicion because, you know, unfortunately, we do live in a society that devalues the feminine, particularly in the workplace. And so that's often a difficult justification for coworkers to make. From my own interviews with coworkers, most of the trans men that I interviewed looked or described themselves as being relatively masculine when they were working as women.
Right.
And so coworkers have this way to kind of naturalize that, where they're like, oh, well, you know, I guess I've always kind of known that he didn't really feel like a woman. Whereas many trans women go from being kind of what we might call sort of stereotypically masculine, where they have careers in the army or the military, and, you know, they're married, they have kids, and coworkers seem to experience a much bigger shock about that. There's a sense that this kind of idea of femininity wasn't really written on the body.
In the same vein, do you think that part of this also stems from the fact that trans men, we often tend to pass much easier than trans women, and so even the after effects are, the appearance is much more jarring sometimes for trans women than it is for trans men.
And I think that, I mean, that is very, very important. I mean, there is really this kind of passing differential. Of course, I mean, it's just an average, but, you know, one thing that I found in my interviews was, even if coworkers were not supportive of trans men becoming men at work, once trans men really start to pass, the coworker looks kind of ridiculous if they keep calling this person she. And so it's kind of the social pressure of like, well, I can't keep she-ing someone who has a beard. And so coworkers kind of like get on board with it because they don't want to look strange. And so I do think that that definitely contributes to a difference in experience.
Right. Now, how does your work compare to, say, the statistics compiled by the Transgender Law Center in their report, Good Jobs Now? They examined employment and economic situations of San Francisco trans people, and I don't know if you're familiar with it, but they surveyed about 200 trans-identified individuals and found that 60% of them earned less than $15,300 a year, and nearly that same percentage reported experiencing employment discrimination. Now, there were more trans women in the study, but at least 23% of them actually identified as trans men.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think that, you know, these studies are often difficult to do because I think if you really want to look at, I mean, you have to take in things into consideration like race, which I think is very important, and also age. And so, I mean, you know, we found in our survey that trans men tended to transition about 10 years earlier than trans women. So many of the people that were in our survey were about 18, 19, or 20. And many of them were also students, which makes sense of why they're going to be making like $15,000 to $20,000 a year, if even that. And so I think the age, like a longitudinal study, I think would be very important in terms of actually making sense of like what's the pattern over time.
Right. For your dissertation, you also dealt with workplace issues transgender people face. So what got you interested in these topics?
Well, I actually, you know, it was kind of a deviation from my earlier research, but I've always been interested in how gender inequality gets reproduced, particularly in the workplace. And I came to the topic, I was actually doing a study on a completely unrelated topic, and I ended up in a workplace where someone had transitioned probably about 10 years before,
mm-hmm.
and before I even worked there. And after I'd been there for a while, people started telling me, like, oh, did you know that so-and-so used to be a woman? I don't know if you know that. Like, it was this kind of office gossip. And I got really interested in terms of why is that still, like, such important gossip 10 years later?
Yeah.
And how does it actually get negotiated? And particularly in sociology, when we think about transgender people, their lives have often been encapsulated in nothing but the transition experience.
Yes. Yeah,
that's the only important thing, is what kind of narrative can you produce about, you know, finding out you were transgender? And then we kind of act like their lives end, right? So, I mean, a lot of books will follow transgender people through support groups.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they kind of leave the support group, it's like, and then they just went out and lived their life.
Right.
And I was really interested in, like, well, what happens when you go out to live your life? And I'm really invested in trying to understand more how, you know, cisgender or non-transgender people think about gender transitions. because I think in order to really combat discrimination, we need to understand how people are thinking about, you know, working with transgender people or even the concept of transgender in general. And that was really my impetus for also interviewing coworkers as well.
Right. What do you think was the biggest thing you learned about from that angle?
I mean, I think the most interesting thing that I learned, two things really, that my sort of hypotheses that I came into the study with was that I expected to find the most resistance coming from heterosexual men. And in fact, I actually found the most sort of support coming from heterosexual men. And that was something that was very surprising to me, just in terms of the gender literature that I went in with. Women, both lesbian and heterosexual, had many more qualms about trans men. They were much more likely to say, I don't really see him as a man, or to experience, I think he's mutilating his body, I feel really uncomfortable with that. And you know, it wasn't that heterosexual men were like, oh, this is great, you know, I totally support it. It was more that they were willing to say, fine, you want to be a man, that's fine, and just not talk about it. Like that they just didn't want to raise questions.
Absolutely, and that's certainly like my personal experience was all the men in my life sort of understood why people want to be men.
Right.
You know, they got it good. They recognized that. Men in my life either, you know, supportive, or just sort of nonchalant about it, whereas the women in my life were very upset about it.
And I think gay men also can be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
One of the most sort of, I guess, depressing things that I found in my research is the trans men I interviewed who were the most unhappy were the people who worked in LGBT-related organizations.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, it sort of blew my mind, I guess, that someone who worked in a construction job in Texas with a bunch of, like, good old boys would have a better experience than someone who worked in California at an LGBT organization. I mean, and so it was particularly that they felt that gay men really tried to separate them from, like, well, you're not really a man,
mm-hmm.
you know, or tried to, you know, kept she-ing them, or really being like, well, you're just kind of a butch who's acting like a man. But at the same time, they found that gay men were very, very negative towards trans women.
Right.
And would say things to trans men without really thinking, like, oh, you might think of yourself as part of a community or something like that. And so I think that, you know, the sense was, it wasn't really that heterosexual men were like, oh, you know, this is great. It was just more that they were like, as long as I can relate to you as a man, I'm going to go along with that.
Right.
And so, I mean, I think that it did create a lot of situations where trans men were kind of encouraged to participate in sort of sexualized talk about women mm-hmm. with other men. Like, well, this is what men do. You know, we talk about women, which could also be kind of uncomfortable.
Right.
But it wasn't the same kind of like boundary guarding that you see from women and from gay men. It was really trying to keep them sort of anchored to what was seen as their birth gender.
Right, absolutely. You were sort of talking about this just a moment ago. You're hoping that this the study that you did and other studies like that will actually be used as evidence to help pass an inclusive INDA.
Yes.
Can you talk about how this kind of work can impact social change?
I've been a little frustrated with the media coverage that we've gotten on some level. Almost all of it is aimed at transgender people. I think there was even a title that's like, before you have that sex change, you better think about your paycheck. And part of me is sort of laughing, because I'm like, well, you know who already knows this? Like, transgender people, right? I mean, it's not a surprise to them that there's discrimination in the workplace. You know, I was hoping that my work would do sort of two different things. And one is really showing that gender identity does matter in the workplace, and that we do need gender identity protections, you know, that people are being treated badly. And even though, you know, we didn't find the same drop for trans men, I would say that trans men are also in a precarious situation. It's just, if they get treated okay at work, they can't rest on that. You never really know what's going to happen. And I think it's not really fair to have that kind of anxiety of like, well, is the other shoe always going to drop, right? So it's not like trans men transition, everyone's like, oh, this is great, and then they kind of go on and live their lives. That if they change jobs, they never know what's going to happen. Is the next workplace going to be as supportive? Is it not? You know, am I going to get fired over, you know, something because I don't have that kind of protection? It is a kind of discrimination to have the sort of precarious workplace setting. And I think that actually having numbers about that is really important, because I think that unfortunately, you know, we are a rights-based society that wants to know about numbers. You know, it's not enough to just say people are being discriminated against, but we want to know, well, how badly is it? And, you know, how many people are, you know, incorporated in that group?
Absolutely. All right, I've just got one last question for you. I read someplace that you do free workplace consultations for trans people coming out. All right, what are your top words of advice?
My top word of advice is I think that the most important thing to having a successful transition is to really go to the top first. I mean, to go to HR or the head people at the workplace and really get them on board. Too often the burden is put on transgender people to do their own kind of educating or to do their own sort of transgender 101 or something like that, which I think is very unfair. It creates an unfair workplace burden. When HR is on board and when, you know, the head person in your company is on board, they can send out an email saying, this is what's happening and here's how we're going to respond to it. And that really makes a difference to coworkers.
Absolutely.
And that's exactly what we found with sexual harassment of women. You know, if you work someplace where the boss says, we don't treat women like this, coworkers don't do it. If you work someplace where the boss is like, well, we can't really protect you, I don't really know what to do, coworkers know that, and if they want to harass you, they will. And so I think that same logic applies, in that top-down support and really kind of putting the burden on the workplace to create a safe environment for everyone is really important.
Awesome. Thank you so much for talking with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is Jacob Anderson Mitchell, and I'm joined here with my co-host,
Rebecca Ney.
And this is Gender Blender on KBOO Radio. And we would like to open up the studio phone line here if any of our listeners would like to come to call in and give us some questions or join in on conversation. The phone number here is 503-231-8187. Up next, we are going to be joined by Diego Sanchez, who was named one of the 100 most influential Latinos in corporate America by Hispanic Business Magazine. Hello, Diego, are you there?
I most certainly am. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thanks, Diego.
Well, it's an honor and a pleasure.
Well, congratulations on your recent appointment as Barney Frank's Senior Legislative Advisor. That's great.
It's a great blessing, and certainly at a tremendous time where my both my identity but also my experience and expertise in LGBT issues and also my expertise in healthcare and human services is so critical at this time as we're looking at health reform and also civil rights movement this year.
That's right. So can you tell us a little bit about what you'll be doing in that position?
Sure. What Barney does is that he assigns particular portfolios of issues to his legislative people. My portfolio is healthcare, LGBT issues, veterans affairs, labor, social security, the census, and the postal service. All of those are areas that I have had experience in that he was really delighted to see. I mean, things that people don't know about me, such as I was actually on the launch team for ZIP Plus 4, the first time that we added the four numbers to the first five in a zip code. I was part of that launch team out of New York on behalf of Pitney Bowes for Burson Marsteller. And so there are a lot of things that I've done in the areas that really don't come up in normal conversation
right.
with people that he knew about, and was just really thrilled to package this portfolio for me. So I'm thrilled to be able to do it. There's a lot to do.
That's great.
And, Diego, as you may have heard listening to the show on the phone, the topic of our show tonight is, and we're dealing with employment issues and how our gender identity impacts employment. And obviously, with you working with Congressman Frank, who has been involved with the Employment Non-Discrimination Act and the controversy surrounding that, Do you mind telling our listeners about the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, and we'll refer to it as ENDA, and, you know, what is detailed in the legislation and why it's necessary?
Sure. I think, actually, your first guest did a great job, and I actually want you to put me in touch with her at some point, if you would.
Oh, sure.
But because I'd love to have a chat with her. I thought her stuff sounded good, and it might be important to include some of her research as we start to launch the new ENDA in this 111th Congress. But to answer your question, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act is something that people like me have been batting around for about 15 years as we have hate crimes legislation, something that says that people have the right to work no matter who those people are, and that when we're American citizens or legal residents, that we should have equal access to employment and equal protection while employed as everyone else. And so the conversations began at a time when only the words sexual orientation were around, that only gay people were identified. And those of us who are trans, I mean, you know, I've been identified as trans for like 30 years. We just sort of hung out with the GL and sort of B community because that was a place that we could make civil rights things happen. For me as a Latino, I also was able to make some movement in communities of color and find that there's a lot of blending in that. But where we are today is that we went through a tremendously painful experience in 2007 where it was time to do the tally on the votes, and the votes for in Congress and the Senate and the House as to whether they wanted people like us, people who needed gender identity and expression included in non-discrimination laws for employment, people would not go that far. Legislators were not willing to go that far with us. There were people in our own circles who looked at legislators eye to eye and were told that they were with us. But the people that they were most accountable to, in my view, which explains why I did what I did, which was to stick with the work to get this law passed. But what the two people that they owed the most to were, number one, Barney Frank, because he is certainly one of the most, he is the LGBT champion of Congress. And if someone looked him in the eye and said, I'm going to vote with you, they had to do it. And if they weren't going to vote with us, they had to look him in the eye and say that they couldn't say that they would vote with us. They didn't have to say they wouldn't, but they would have to say that it was possible that they would not. And that means no. No means no, which I know now in Congress having by my work there. The other person they're accountable to is Joe Somanes of the Human Rights Campaign, who organizes tremendous, tremendous, tremendous work that organizes funding that gets people elected.
So right, and I think you're starting to talk about what, you know, what was, especially within the transgender community, a controversy around the Human Rights Campaign, which Joe Solon is involved with, their support not of an inclusive INDA, but of an INDA that was stripped of the transgender portion of the bill.
The gender identity portion.
Right. I just want to make sure that our listeners are, you know, caught up to where you are. And as you obviously are, you're sort of addressing many transgender activists, you know, wouldn't work with HRC afterwards, and you're doing you're telling us exactly why it is that you continue to do so. So can you continue with that?
Absolutely. My involvement with HRC was about 20 years strong. I'd started working with them about 20 years ago. And being left out at absolutely more avenues than I could ever tell you. But it was the largest organization, the most influential, and I figured if I stuck around long enough, there would be more of us and we could make a difference. So that's why I stayed when we were totally ignored. And then eventually, about 10 years ago, they recognized we were around, which was improvement. And then after that, we got to do different levels of inclusion. Never full inclusion, but, you know, as I say, I'm a person of color, so my experience and tolerance of exclusion is going to always be different than white people's, because I've got experience with exclusion that has nothing to do with being trans. And so I know that if I hang out long enough, and if I'm smart enough, and I can get other people around me who are tolerant enough and get to know me enough, and others get to know other people enough, eventually we'll be okay. So what happened is the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, when we realized that there were not votes, many people thought there were the votes because they were looked in the eye and told, I'm with you. I don't know if they actually asked the question, will you vote for us, and this is what it will cost you if you're lying to me. But that's what they know when they look at Barney Frank and when they look at Joe Somanes. And those two people said there were not the votes. Everyone else felt like they heard enough to think that there were the votes. And so I just have to say who has the most power and who do people have to be honest with. And that's where I had to align myself. It was like, you know what, I know Barney, and I know that he would love to have an inclusive bill so this could just be over with. But if there weren't the votes, he couldn't put it out there. Now, as a layman, as a person where I was where you are, as an advocate in the community, I didn't really understand why it's important to pass something rather than nothing. Because the big argument in the community was, if we just pass an inclusive bill or try to pass one and Bush rejects it, you know, it doesn't matter if we pass it or fail it, because Bush is going to reject it. That was the thing from the community. If we don't have the votes, so be it. Let's just put it out there, because Bush is going to reject it anyway. This is just practice. What I've learned as a person who works in Congress is that the most important thing about a bill in the last Congress is that it passed. Every time a bill comes up after it's re-entered in this Congress, in the 111th, the first statement that you give to everybody that you want, people like me, to look at and put that before their boss for a yes or a no, with a recommendation from people like me, the staffers. The first line is, your boss voted for this the last session and it passed. That tells people that they are less out on a limb, there's less to explain, and the only thing that we'll have to add this time is to say, this is essentially the same bill as last time, with the exception of adding gender identity. And that's much better than this bill went through the House and it failed. So this year we have to reintroduce something that failed that has sexual orientation and gender identity. I'm telling you as a staffer, and I can't worry about whether people believe this, but I now, for the first time in my life, actually do this. And I will tell you that it's easier for me to move bills forward that already have been passed somewhere.
Excellent. We're just going to break in here to follow up just on what you've been talking about.
So we're talking with Diego Sanchez. He is the staffer for Congressman Barney Frank. And Diego, how have you, as a trans person, and you've been speaking about this, been able to, besides obviously coming on shows like this, been able to communicate to the lay public like us, who really, you know, it's hard for us to understand how, you know, somebody like Barney Frank, who will say that he advocates for us, support a bill that doesn't include gender identity. How have you been able to, and you've been talking about, you led into my next question about how you as a trans person were able to influence some attitudes and opinions on the Hill. But so I'm going to turn this question around. How have you been able to explain it to people like us it's hard for us to accept the incremental rights position.
Right. I totally understand, because you know what? Who wants to be left out? There is no way I can explain why it feels good to be left out, because it doesn't. It is the most horrendous feeling to feel excluded. And I think the closest thing I can say to how I explain it is an experience of my own life, which is that when I was a child, I grew up in the Panama Canal, where I could swim in the Pacific or the Atlantic Ocean. I never got caught in a riptide. I never needed to be captured by a lifeguard. I was a brilliant and incredible swimmer. When I was 7 years old and my family moved to the United States, to Augusta, Georgia, I was precluded from swimming in public swimming pools simply because I wasn't white.
Right.
I could outswim absolutely everyone in that pool. There is no question, because I've been on both oceans, the Pacific, which is not as Pacific, and the Atlantic, which is actually more Pacific. And so I didn't understand why can't I swim in pools when I have the capacity to navigate oceans where there's no wall, there's no ladder.
Right.
You know, there are beings and there are fish in the water, and you could get bit by jellyfish and step on crabs and, you know, all the stuff that happens in natural habitats. I had to learn that sometimes the environment designs the borders of acceptance. Mm-hmm. And your job is to be that fox and lay in wait and find that opening and find that hole when it exists. And so I've been trained differently than other people. Most people who I know, honestly, there are so few of us who are of color in my community, that most people are white, and they're not used to being rejected or left behind or unassumed or followed by security in a little grocery store.
That's a great point.
That's not everybody's experience, but it is mine. So how I explain it is to say, You know, imagine that suddenly everything you are is not understood by everyone around you. And how do you navigate those waters? How do you normalize yourself? How do you make people comfortable with your difference? And that's part of what my entire life experience has been around. So I have a lot. I'm 52 years old. I've had a lot of experience at walking and believing in Bubba Land. You mentioned Bubba earlier in your other interview. You know, we all know Bubba. I grew up with Bubba. You know, so I didn't get killed living with Bubbas. So there are certain tools and skills that I've had to learn to survive that distinguish me from a lot of people in my community. And how I explain it is only to say, you know what? We're all going to be glad when we get this law done. But if none of us are at the table to look them in the eye and go, you better include us this time, you better include us. If no one is there, then no one is there.
Absolutely.
And I had to be there.
We hate to break in right now, but we've got to cut you off. And thank you again for being on our show. We really appreciate it. We appreciate everything you've been talking about. We just need to move on.
And we've been...
Just look for a new handout with gender identity included with sexual orientation this year.
Awesome.
We appreciate
your
work.
We will look for it.
Diego Sanchez, the Senior Policy Advisor for Congressman Barney Frank.
Take care.
Bye. Thank you. Take care. All right. We have been talking about gender in the workplace with some very fabulous guests. And if you want to download a copy of the show, you can find us online at kboo.fm/genderblender. And we also want to thank our wonderful engineer, Terrace. Thank you so much, Terrace. You've been great tonight and every night. All right. We're going to leave you with some border crossing from our lovely folk singing trans woman named Molly Brennett.
Listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. The time is now 7 o'clock, and this is again KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, K220HR, White Salmon, Washington, and K264AA in Corvallis. Coming up next is Hard Knock Radio with DVD, but now let's listen to some community calendar.
This is the community calendar for Tuesday, March 17th. The Cascadia Rising Tide Open Meeting takes place Tuesday, March 17th, 6 p.m. to 7 p.m., monthly at 6 p.m. on the third Tuesday at the Red and Black Cafe, 400 Southeast 12th Avenue. The Hosford Abernathy Neighborhood Development Association meeting takes place tonight, Tuesday, March 17th, from 7 to 8 p.m. It's monthly at 7 p.m. on the third Tuesday at St. Philip Neri, St. Paul Classroom, 2408 Southeast 16th Avenue, Portland. Phone 503-231-4955. Knitters, crocheters, needlepoint artists, and other crafters come to the Cube Space Wednesday nights from 5 to 6 p.m. to show off your current project, ask for advice on a problem area, or just enjoy the company. The Cube Space is at 622 Southeast Grand Avenue, Portland. The Sisters Circle, Empowerment for Women of Color, meets Wednesday, March 18th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Women's Resource Center at Portland State University. Children always welcome. Call 503-725-9780. Mount Tabor Presbyterian Church conducts weekly divorce care for kids programs to help children heal from the pain of divorce and separation. Everyone is welcome each Wednesday evening at 7 to 8 p.m. at Mount Tabor Presbyterian Church, 5441 Southeast Belmont Street. A Celtic celebration is the theme for Cascade Singers' St. Patrick's Day concert. It takes place today, Tuesday, March 17th, 7:30 p.m., at St. Peter's Landmark, 3rd and Lincoln Streets in the Dales. Music features Irish, Scottish, and Hebridean melodies from many places, performed by the choir, ensemble, and the almost all-Irish, almost all-brass band. Admissions a free will offering to benefit St. Peter's Landmark. Portland Central America Solidarity Committee meets Wednesday, March 18th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at Liberty Hall, 311 North Ivy Street in Portland. PCASC is a grassroots organization working for international solidarity and immigrant rights. The People's Farmers Market takes place Wednesdays, 2 to 7 p.m. It's a year-round market at 3029 Southeast 21st Avenue, one block north of Powell Boulevard. For more information, call Ariana Jacob at 503-232-9051. There's a free sack lunch concert Wednesday, March 18th at noon at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. David Rothman, pianist, will play Chopin Etudes and a Fantasy. This has been Paula for the Community Calendar for KABU 90.7 FM in Portland. Listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio. Transmitting from...